Psalm 90 verse 1, as we just had it on screen, says these words, Lord, you have been our dwelling place. If we were to rephrase that today, we would say this, God, you are my home. I want you to think about that for a moment, because it's kind of an abstract thought, but it's a beautiful thought. God, you are my home. The word home might mean different things for different people, and I don't know each of your story, but for some of you, the word home might not be a positive idea. But at the core of the idea of home should be this, that home is a place, one is where you dwell. That's why in the old language it's called like the dwelling place. So the home is like where you live, where you find yourself. But it's more than that. It's not the house. The home is that place where you can be at rest. I mean, practically, home is where you lay your head down, isn't it? Wherever I lay my head, that's my home. You know, and so it's that place where you lie down at night and you sleep. But if you think about that idea, to be at home should be to be at rest. Home is not always this, but home should be a place that is safe. When we say that, God, you have been my dwelling place, or God, you are my home, God, you are where I find my rest. God, you are where I am at peace. God, you are my safe place. Imagine for a moment, though, if you had life without home. In the world today, we would call that being a refugee. To have life without a home. To have nowhere that you can know that this is where I belong. This is where I'm safe. This is where I lay my head and I sleep at peace knowing all is okay. What's it like to not have a place to call home? And then if you take the two ideas together and you go, what would it be like to not have somewhere to call home, to be homeless, but also to feel in that moment that you also had no God? To be godless. What would it be like to think in this life, physically and where I am, I have nowhere that I belong and feel safe, but then also in my spirit, in my true self, to go, I have no purpose and identity because God is far from me. What would it be like to be homeless and godless? To be feeling like I don't belong, and the one who put all this life in place has abandoned me. This was the experience of the people of Israel, God's people. And we want to consider their story today as we come continuing our seeking of God. Is that for the people of Israel, though they had at times been able to say, God, you are our dwelling place. God, we are at rest in you. There came a time in the life of the nation of Israel where they were homeless and they felt godless. They felt that God had abandoned them. The reality was this, that Israel had come to a point where they had abandoned God. They, instead of coming and continually wanting to come and to know God and to know his love and to love him and to follow him, And for them, that was all around their nation of Israel and the city of Jerusalem and the temple worship was how God had said, this is how you can come and know me and be close to me. This is how I will not only be your home, but you will dwell with me and I will dwell with you. I'll make you my home. And yet for the people of Israel, they came to a point where as they were in a way infected by the people around them who did not know God, that they came to a point where they abandoned God, where they didn't go to the temple to worship God. They raised up other temples and shrines and altars to gods that weren't real and gods that were evil, and they worshipped other gods, and they got caught up in this whole idolatry. And with that came a lot of corruption as well, both in the way that they treated each other and the way that they loved the things in front of them more than the God who gave them those gifts. And so there came a point in time where, as they abandoned God, God said, well, I'll give you what you want. I'll give you all the idols you want. And the king Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon came down into Israel and took all those people around Jerusalem, the people of Judah, who were all that remained at that time. And he took them away to Babylon, where they could have their fill of idols. And when they got to Babylon, they wept. Some of you know the song, you know, I'm not going to sing it, but you know. But by the rivers, they wept. Because they remembered Zion, they remembered home. And while they were in Babylon, they were homeless and they felt godless, that God had abandoned them. But the truth was, they had abandoned God. They were there in Babylon for 70 years. Now, that's a long time. I mean, a lot of them would have died in that time, but others were still alive at the end of that 70 years. And during that time, you wonder, what was it like to be living long-term somewhere that's not your home? Most of us here, we don't know what that's like. Every now and then, I meet somebody who's come to New Zealand as a refugee, and I've met, like, one of my friends, a man, he's come from Myanmar to Thailand to here. He was homeless in Thailand for around 30 years. That's a long time to be without a home. For the people of Israel, it was for 70 years homeless. And then comes the story that we get to read about in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. So if you've got your Bible, turn there to Ezra. If you haven't got one, it's not going to be on screen today. We had a technical glitch on my end today, so you need one. So either turn on your app, get your Bible out, or throw your hand up and Jeremy will get your Bible. If you want a Bible now, just throw your hand up. But we're going to be in Ezra and Nehemiah. And I'd really encourage you, if you're not familiar with these stories, have a read of these this week. We're not going to do all of the story, but it's an amazing story of God at work. And I would say through the mundane, through the ordinary, even though it's dramatic. We don't read in these books about God's voice, and we don't read about the supernatural. And yet all of it is full of God's work and His supernatural. It's an incredible story, the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. But it begins way before Ezra and Nehemiah actually turn up on the scene. At the end of 70 years, God is at work. And though we're going to consider Ezra and Nehemiah as they seek God, what we need to get first is that before Ezra and Nehemiah step onto the stage, God has already center stage. Ezra chapter 1 verse 1 says these words, "The Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia." Now, Cyrus is the main guy. Like he is the king of this massive kingdom that took over from the Babylonians, and he's the one now who has the Israelites in exile. And God moves in his heart. It's not like some prophet comes to him. It's not Ezra or Nehemiah come to him. Here's this guy, Cyrus, who's fully thinking, I'm the king. He calls himself like the King of Kings. And as the King of Kings, he doesn't even really realize who the king is. And God's going, Cyrus, I'm just going to change your mind right now. I'm just going to tweak your heart right now. You know those Israelites that are with you? You know, I want you to send them home. Send them back because I want them back in Israel. I want them back in Jerusalem. And this incredible thing takes place where Cyrus gets the leaders together of Israel and says, you guys go back home. And in fact, don't just go back home. I want to send you there with all you need to go back home and rebuild your temple so that you can go back and worship your God. Like, I don't know, but like in the history of the world, from my understanding, Israel seems to be the only nation that keeps on getting to go back home. When other nations are dispersed and their culture is destroyed and their religion is destroyed, they don't rebirth again. Israel, everything's been destroyed. Their city's been burnt down. The temple's been destroyed. Their worship of God is over. They're taken away to be slaves. And the king of where they live, after 70 years, this new king, says, oh, actually, you guys go home. Rebuild your city. Build your temple. Worship your God. That does not happen in our world unless God is at work. And God moves the heart of the king. So the people return to Jerusalem and they begin to rebuild. They lay the foundation of the temple. And when they'd finished like laying the floor, so we haven't got any walls up yet, they've just got the floor down. It's not even like a roof on shout, floor only, but they celebrate. Such a big deal. To be homeless as a nation for 70 years and you've got the floor down on your new home, it's pretty exciting stuff. And as the floor goes down and they begin to celebrate, chapter 3, verse 11, these are the words of their song of praise. He is good. His love towards Israel endures forever. Do you see that? Ezra 3:11. He is good. His love toward Israel endures forever. You've got to get a load of that because they've been the ones feeling abandoned by God. And suddenly they're talking about a word like endure. It's as if they suddenly realize, even in the 70 years that we felt abandoned, you have been good. Your love never gave up on us. But I want you to notice something interesting. If you go down to verse 13, that while they're shouting for joy and singing for joy, there's another sound going on. No one could distinguish the sounds of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise. And if you read the verses before that, you'll see that what happened is that within the crowd, or the multitude, and they're all praising God, you are good, your love endures forever. And then some, who are the elderly, they're weeping, they're crying. And I guess there's a lot of emotion. You've come home, they're the ones who used to live in Jerusalem. The rest of the ones who are all partying are the ones born in Babylon have only heard the stories. And they're pretty excited to be at home. But the ones who remember from before, who have returned home, they weep because they remember what their city was like. They remember the beauty of the temple. They remember the beauty of the city. And so though they come in a sense with joy that God has brought us home, they weep because they remember what was. And the writer's saying, it was so noisy and you couldn't tell who was crying and who was singing. But it says this at the end, and the sound was heard from far away. People could hear this noise of Jerusalem because Jerusalem, the people of God, were home. Now they get the foundation down and then it took them 20 years to build the temple. You go, oh man, it's just a slower building back then. No, it took 20 years because there was delay after delay. They hit huge opposition to build the temple. At one point, a new king said to them, you've got to stop building. And then later on, another king says, you can start building again. It took 20 years. Finally, at the end of a 20-year project, they finally finished. I remember when we bought this place, and it took us 2 years to be able to start worshiping in here. From when we bought it to when we got in here, it took more than 2 years because we had to like sort so much stuff out with the building and redoing it and getting code of compliance and resource consent. It took forever, 2 years. These guys took 20 years before they could go to church. It's a long time. So by the end of 20 years, they finished the temple and they came and they worshiped God and they celebrated. It's interesting, though, that Ezra and Nehemiah, these guys in the stories, they don't turn up for another 50 years. So here's the temple in Jerusalem, the temple. And there's the rest of Jerusalem, and it's a ruin. And all its walls that gave it protection and made it a home, made it safe, a place where they could be at rest, were broken down. And they were so vulnerable to the enemy, to wild animals, and that though they'd come and they could worship God in the temple, it wasn't long before their hearts were being drawn away from God again. And for 50 years, Jerusalem was still a mess. It was still like a pile of rubble with a temple in the middle of it. And after these 50 more years, so it's interesting, think about that. From when they went to build the foundation, how many years have taken place? How many? Do you maths? No one's bold enough? 70. How many years were they in exile in Babylon? That's getting a lot of years, isn't it? Like, so they're away homeless for 70 years. They finally come home and they're living in a mess. They're living in a broken home for 70 years, not just physically broken either. And then we meet Ezra. Ezra chapter 7. And it tells us that Ezra, in verse 12, that he was a priest and a teacher of the law of God. And this unusual thing happens. Look at verse 23. There's this new king, Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And these are his words. Whatever the God of heaven has prescribed, let it be done with diligence for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should his wrath fall on the realm of the king and of his sons? So I'm not sure what tweaked Artaxerxes' mind, but somewhere in there, and it's probably God at work again, just like he was in Cyrus, he's going, man, the temple's been rebuilt in Jerusalem, but what if the people of Israel that my, you know, forefathers sent there, what if they are doing it wrong? And what if their God, who I've heard historically is pretty powerful, what if he gets upset with that and he comes and it lands on me? And so he's got this idea where he says, Ezra, you're one who is a priest, you're a teacher of the law, I want you to go to Jerusalem, and I want you to make sure that everything's in order of the worship of your God at the temple. And I'm a bit worried too, because maybe your temple's not good enough for this great God you serve, so I want to send you with all the gold and silver and precious treasures that you need. I want you just to take all this stuff and make sure that the temple of your God is beautiful. Isn't that bizarre? Like foreign pagan king is going like, man, I'll send all my riches so that you guys can have a beautiful temple. Look at Ezra 7:27. Ezra understands that, in fact, before Ezra will be at work, God is at work. Praise be to the Lord, the God of our ancestors, who has put it into the king's heart to bring honor to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in this way, and has extended his good favor to me before the king. You see, what Ezra recognizes is before Ezra has even done anything, he recognizes that God is at work in the heart of the king, that God's given him favor in the heart of the king. And so Ezra gathers together all the treasures from the king, and he gathers together the people that are going to return with him. And then you come to Ezra 8, just go there, verse 21. And now the story, in a sense, for us today begins after these 70 years. The story of Ezra and Nehemiah seeking God, which is what we're seeking to do as a church at the moment. We want to seek him. It says this of Ezra. He says, I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before our God and ask him for a safe journey for us and our children with all our possessions. And then he tells us why. I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from the enemies on the road, because I told the king the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him, but his great anger is against those that forsake him. So we fasted and petitioned our God about this. Now, do you see what's going on here? That Ezra is going like, oh, king, thanks for all the treasures. We'll be okay because our God is with us. And then he's going, oh, no. We've got to travel down to Jerusalem, which is a dangerous road, where we are going to be very vulnerable because we have no military power at all, and we're loaded with gold and silver. There's a high chance that we're going to get robbed on the way. And I am too embarrassed to say to the king, king, could you send some soldiers with us? Because I just told the king that God looks after us. And so what he does is he proclaims a fast. The people of Israel are in Babylon, they fast, they go without food, and they come and they humble themselves before God, and they go, God, protect us on the journey. God, keep us safe. God, bring us to Jerusalem with all that we've been entrusted with the king. And it says there in that verse 23, so we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayer. Go to verse 31. They arrive in Jerusalem, and look at what it says. The hand of our God was on us, and he protected us from enemies and bandits along the way. Verse 34, everything was accounted for by number and weight. No corruption within, no bandits without. Like, God answered their prayer. And I want you to see this, that Ezra is about the high detail. He wants everything to be done right. He's done a count of every ounce of gold and silver before they leave, because he's accountable to that, to the king and to his king. And when he arrives, they do a count again, and it's all accounted for. God has answered their prayer. And yet Ezra is like, it's almost like there's this excitement. Man, God has moved the heart of the king. We've been given all this treasure. We're going to beautify the temple. We've arrived unharmed, nothing missing. How good is this? Let's get the worship happening. And then as he arrives, the leaders come to him and they go, Ezra, we're a bit embarrassed, but over the last 50 years since we've been here and the temple's been established, we've gone and done it again. We've intermarried with people outside of our nation, and implied in that, and if you read through, it talks about it's a bit like in Solomon's day, that these marriages are with those who worship other gods, and with that is going to come corruption. And there's this grief, like Ezra just rips his clothes and he just falls to the ground and he can't believe it. He's come to beautify the temple, to restore worship in the land, and the people have already had their hearts turned from God. And he grieves. Chapter 9, verse 5. So he all day he's just like prostrate before God. And then verse 5, then at the evening sacrifice I rose from my self-abasement with my tunic and cloak torn. And then I fell on my knees with my hands spread out to the Lord my God, and I prayed. It's as if like the whole day he hasn't been praying. He's just been going, what has happened? How can we be so far from you, God? How can we take all your rich generosity and just rub it in your face? And that's what he goes on to say. He's saying in this prayer, he's going, I am so ashamed and disgraced before you, God, because we have not responded how we should to your generosity and your goodness and your grace. And what I find interesting is that as these people have intermarried and become influenced by the gods again that had them led to exile, where was Ezra? Well, that was going on. Where was he? He was in Babylon. And what was he doing? Studying the law. He was not marrying the Gentile lady next door and being influenced by her gods. And yet if you read his prayer, you would think that Ezra was living in Jerusalem and had married the Gentile neighbor and was influenced by her gods, because he says, we have sinned. I think it's just so interesting that when we come and we seek God, that what we learn here is that that's something we do together. And if there's faults and failings and sin that we have, we own that together. That's what Ezra does here. And what's interesting is that Ezra, a leader, comes and he's just saying, God, we have sinned. We've been far from you. Look at what chapter 10, verse 1 says. While Ezra was praying and confessing and weeping, throwing himself down before the house of God, a large crowd of Israelites, men, women, children, gathered around him, and they too wept bitterly. Do you see what happens? So he goes from almost like private, he's just weeping before God, he's seeking God. And then he comes to the temple and he goes public and he goes, God, we need you to show us grace because we are disgraced. And he does that, the people gather around and they come and they cry out to God as well. And then it says this, verse 6, then Ezra withdrew from before the house of God. While he was there, he ate no food and he drank no water because he continued to mourn over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. So then he withdraws and he privately is seeking God. if you read on the story, you find that Ezra and the leaders and then all the people, they return to God. As they've come and they've sought God for forgiveness, he forgives them. And they return to him. And they return to worship, and Ezra does this work of beautifying the temple and restoring worship. Meanwhile, back in Babylon, there's another guy, and his name is Nehemiah. And Nehemiah is the guy that goes to the same king that Ezra had been to, Artaxerxes, and he's the one who fills up the cup and gives him his wine each day. And he's heard what's going on in Jerusalem too. He's heard that though the temple is restored, the rest of the place is a mess and the home is not ready to be a place of peace. And as he hears it, it's interesting that it says this, Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 4, "When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the Lord of heaven." So here's this guy Nehemiah, he's not a student of the law, he's a guy that works on the bar. He serves the king his wine each day. And so as he's doing that, as he's the bartender to the king, he too has a love for Jerusalem and longs for it to be home. And he hears the reports that it's still a rubble. And he starts for some days to pray. He fasts, he mourns, he prays. Do you know how long that some days is? For 4 months. For 4 months. He's just grieving before God over Jerusalem. And at the end of 4 days, he prays a prayer. And you can read it later in chapter 1 there. He prays this prayer to God. A prayer that, like Ezra, says, "God, we're in this place because of our sin." He owns it for himself. But then at the end, look at verse 11. "Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man." And then it says, "I was cupbearer to the king." What Nehemiah is saying, he's saying, "I'm about to go before the king, the man, who I just serve wine to each day. But I'm going to go and make a request of him." And Nehemiah tells us that he's freaking out. It says he's afraid. So for 4 months, he's been fasting and praying and mourning. And then he prays this prayer one morning. I don't know why, but that morning he gets up and goes, "God, today's the day. Grant me favor before the king, before this man." And he goes before the king. And for 4 months, you've got to think about this. For 4 months, he's been mourning and fasting. But every day when he turns up to the king to serve the wine, he puts on a smiley face. Because it tells us in here that on this day, it's the first time that he came before the king looking as if he were in grief. You see that? Like he's grieving internally, but he's not showing it. But on this day, he comes and he lets the king see his true face. And that's a risk right there, because the king might be, "Why are you looking so grumpy? I don't like you anymore. You've gone," you know? But the king, it's interesting what happens here. Verse 4, chapter 2, verse 4, "The king said to me, 'What is it you want?'" It's so interesting, isn't it, that the king who doesn't need to know what his servant wants, doesn't need to know why his servant is miserable, is actually drawn into that. And then Nehemiah says this, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king." Do you see that he's been seeking God for 4 months, and then in this moment, as he suddenly shows his true face and the king says, "What's up?" And he's like, "Oh God, I need you right now." See, he's still seeking God in the moment because he's afraid. Chapter 2, verse 6, "Then the king with the queen sitting beside him asked me, 'How long will your journey take? And when will you get back?'" So like he's told the king what he needs, and he's told him his request, "I want to go to Jerusalem. I want to sort this place out and rebuild the walls." And the king's actually gone like, "Okay, that's fine. When do you want to go?" Do you see the difference? Like he's expecting the king, that he's going to somehow have to convince the king that he's risking his life to make this request to the king. And yet when he says to the king, "Well, actually, I want to go and rebuild my city," the king goes, "Okay, when? What do you need?" And so it pleased the king to send me. So I set a time. I just think, Nehemiah sees God move the heart of the king. So Nehemiah, he cruises down to Jerusalem. He's got all he needs from the king. The king supplies him with all the wood and stuff he needs to build the city walls and the gates. The king even sends him with soldiers and a guard so he doesn't have to pray like Ezra for protection. He just cruises on down. And you think, man, Nehemiah, after 4 months seeking God, you are here in Jerusalem. You got all the gear you need, all the soldiers you need. Just build the city. And do you know what he does? He goes secretly around the city to check it out. He's still quite a bit nervous, I think. He wants to see what's going on. He's trying to figure out how will they build the city. Verse 12 of chapter 2, he had not told anyone what God had put in his heart to do for Jerusalem. See, God had put in his heart to rebuild Jerusalem, and he's kept it to himself. But now comes this time where he looks at the city, and then he gathers the leaders, and he says, the time has come for us to rebuild the city. And he told them about the gracious hand of God on him and what the king had said. And the people said, let's rebuild it. And here's what happens. This is cool. So, 20 years to build the temple, 50 years mucking around, messing around, 52 days to build all the city walls and gates. See how incredible that is? See what happens when a man seeks God and God's already at work? And I want to tell you, you read the rest of Nehemiah, and they had obstacle after obstacle. They had all these things go against them. And in 52 days, they rebuilt the city walls and made Jerusalem their home, their safe place. And you go, so what's the meaning of all this? I tell you, here's the meaning. Is that the whole time, God was at work. While Ezra was seeking God, God was already working. While Nehemiah was seeking God, God was already working. You see, God was seeking to live amongst his people while they were seeking to live with their God. We're coming to seek God, and you know what? God is already at work amongst us. He's already doing his work here. On this day when the walls were finished and the gates were built, and it was now a home, this is what happened. Ezra and Nehemiah called up all the singers, the choir. They formed these choirs like David had commanded years ago, and they got all the choir up on the city walls, big walls. And Ezra, he's a bit of a worship leader. He must have a good voice. So he had half the choir with him up on the wall. And Nehemiah, he's got the other half of the choir, but he can't sing very good because he doesn't lead them. He just tails along at the back. And Ezra heads off around the wall leading the song, and they're singing praises to God. They're full of great joy as they sing and they go around the wall. And Nehemiah, imagine how pumped he is on this wall that he's built. And there goes the second choir led by, we don't know who, but Nehemiah's just at the back and he's singing along in his flat voice. But he's joyful too, like some of us. And they're singing that way. And you see these two big choirs are singing, they're praising God, they're joyful in God. And then they meet at the temple and they worship God. And remember that way back, 70 years before, when the foundation was laid and their voices were heard from afar? Look at what it says here. Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 43. As they're singing before God in front of the temple, having sung around the walls, they're not going, go Ezra. It's not go Nehemiah. It's go God. It's not going, look what we did. It's going, look what you did, God. On that day, they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. The women and children rejoiced also. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard from afar. I want to encourage you that God is already at work in this church and in your life and in your family and in your community. But he's looking for men and women who will say, I want you, God. I want to be involved with what you are doing already. I want to be helping this world to be a home for people so they can know you and be safe in this life. God, I want in on what you are already doing. Let's just pray. Lord God, we come today and we're going to be seeking you. because you are good and your love endures forever. But today, would you open our eyes to the fact that you are already at work? Help us to see that, God. You are already at work. And move our hearts to join in the work that you are already doing of making people's hearts your dwelling place. And in a way, then you become our dwelling place. Help us to come right now and to seek you, Lord.